Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Glad you could join me. Great show in store for you. Looking forward to learning a lot about our dogs and how to take better care of them by Joe Spoo. You know him as the gun dog doc, the guy spends his working and his hunting hours in South Dakota, knows a little bit about treating gun dogs. Many of your questions and many of mine will be answered by Joe coming up very soon. But that's not all. In our Handle It segment this week, I'll answer a question from Ben Waters. Yeah, maybe you've had this happen, a retrieving battle between two dogs. It ends up with, pieces of bird on that retrieve. So we'll deal with that one, and we'll also take a shooting lesson from you. Yeah, so many of you had tips for us on shooting from our social media posts. Looking forward to getting some advice that might help you and you and you and, of course, me. Yeah, the Upland Nation podcast is right here, right now, made possible by Sage and Breaker, Pointer Shotguns, Mid Valley Clays, Truelock Chokes, Midway USA, Purina Pro Plan Sport, LandTrust.com, ESPAmerica.com, and High Viz Shooting Systems. Well, speaking of shooting tips, I've been working hard at the range, my own range, and then the one where I can meet with other people too, on doubles. Yeah, you know, I'm getting to the point where I think I can hit a lot of singles. Yeah, not all of them. I'll never do that. But now I'm working on keeping my cheek into the stock, not looking at the first bird falling before I shoot the second bird. I'm just trying to focus. Yeah, just focus. Yeah, I'll let you know how it works. But in the meanwhile, sure is fun. You are focusing on the same thing to a great degree. And I thought this time of year, when everybody is doing that, I'd ask you all for your best shooting tips. And here are just some of them. Go on the Facebook or the Instagram pages, because there are hundreds of bits of advice scattered over the World Wide Web on my social media pages. Bob Welsh. Bob, great to hear from you, by the way. Hope you're doing well. Point of impact shooting on cardboard with the chokes and loads you use to hunt or target shoot. Absolutely. Get to know your gun a little bit better, he says. Pitch, drop it, heel, comb and stock length, etc., etc. Olson's Gun Dogs. I try to stay calm. And then he admits it. Sometimes I panic and tense up. Don't we all? Practice, practice, practice is Hunter the GSP's advice. Paul Sternad says, keep the barrel moving. David Klopp, keep your face held tight to your stock and practice your gun mount. Yeah, absolutely. And you might recall recently, Don Curry reminded us that that gun mount needs to be slow and deliberate. Yeah, that is so true. I've seen it happen both ways. I used to blame it on a lighter, whippier gun when I was shooting my 28, but I think it's just a matter of discipline. Robert Smith, yes, we've all been there. Shooting is really hard if you forget to bring the gun and ammo. Don't overthink on the birds is Bruce Wondrack's piece of advice. Absolutely true. Barry Osher, great idea. Catch all of your ejected shells. Leave only footprints in your wake. Lucas Mavericks advice, mount your gun at home every day a few times for muscle memory. Yeah, you know, it's really funny. We think about shooting as one of those ingrained skills from pioneer days. It's in our DNA, but it is an athletic event just like golf, baseball, or anything else. So a little practice goes a long way. Bill Nadeau is one of those guys who advocates the STEP program, Step Toward the Bird. Shooting starts from below the waist. I like that idea, and it might help me. Well, it all helps me. Gerald Giordano says, check your choke size. Yeah, I'm becoming a bigger and bigger believer in that. Those are the things that you know, you don't think about quite as much, and I sure appreciate everybody reminding us of the things that are important when it comes to connecting on birds or clay targets. Yeah, and that segment of the program is brought to you in part by Purina Pro Plan Sport Dog Food. You want to learn more about all the formulations and why I like it so much, go to ProPlanSport.com. Yes, whether you're looking for a specific sport puppy formula or something for a dog in its golden years, they've got something for you, a wide variety of options to help your dog perform in the field. Yeah, whether it's VO2 max, joint health, or anything else, Pro Plan Sport is designed for active, hardworking, everyday athletes like your sporting dog. ProPlanSport.com. And Hi-Vis shooting systems have been helping me lately. Yeah, I don't care what your style of shooting is. I don't care what you're shooting at. The relationship between your eyes, the muzzle, and the target are, you know, the things that make you hit or miss. And Hi-Vis has a system that might help you, whether it's their patented interlocking light pipe system, some of their screw-in or magnetic attachment beads. There's a reason their original equipment on Ruger, Benelli, Remington, among others. Learn more about how Hi-Vis Sights can help you at HiVizSights.com, H-I-V-I-Z, Sights.com. Well, we met finally at Pheasant Fest this past, whenever it was, March, I think. Joe Spoo is known well as the Gun Dog Doc, and that's where you learn more about him, GundogDoc.com. He's from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and one of the few private practice veterinarians board certified by the American College of Veterinary Sports Medicine and Rehabilitation, and probably the only one focusing on hunting dogs. So we got him, and I'm looking forward to learning more. Joe Spoo, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's a mouthful of a qualification. I mean, how hard did you have to work to get that board certification?
A lot of hoops to jump through, that's for sure. It's I always joke that they chose the longest title and acronym possible for that specialty college, because it is a mouthful.
Yeah. Do you find that specialty coming in handy in a place like South Dakota?
So it's interesting. To be quite honest, you know, the board certification process and becoming a hunting dog, sporting dog expert was kind of a selfish endeavor. It was something I wanted to do. I purchased the Gun Dog Doc domain almost 25 years ago, long before there was a sports medicine and rehabilitation specialty college. And it was my career and life goal to become the best hunting dog veterinarian that I could. For my own dogs, right? Because that's what I do as a veterinarian and as someone that loves these dogs and hunts. I wanted to provide the absolute best care I could for my dogs. I get interested from the performance aspect of it as well. And so I previously used to run a lot of marathons, triathlons, and the tweaking of performance through, you know, conditioning, through nutrition. I didn't understand why we weren't doing a lot of those things to the degree that we could with dogs. And so it was kind of a selfish endeavor. Do you need to be a board certified specialist or at the time that I became it to practice in Sioux Falls, South Dakota? No. But through that process, I also met my wife, who's a veterinary specialist, and we ended up growing a pretty successful specialty / general practice veterinary practice here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So it all really worked out, but at the end of the day, the endeavor was for me to be the best veterinarian I could be for my own dogs, and then obviously, you know, clients and friends and hopefully the hunting dog world that benefited from that obsession of mine.
Well, you know, it's funny. We want to be the best at taking care of our dogs as well. So we got a lot in common. And I think that I appreciate that motivation more than anything else. So tell me about your dogs. Tell me about your season. How was the season out there this year?
Pretty good. So we started, I moved here 21-22 years ago, whatever it was, because our duck hunting for non-residents is a lottery system. And the second year I didn't draw for a lottery, I said I'm moving to South Dakota and I'll figure the rest out when I get there. And so I'm predominantly, you know, moved out here as a duck hunter, and the duck season, the first half of the season was phenomenal. We had just a really good early season between the teal, Wigeon and gadwall. I do a lot of prairie bird hunting. That was a little frustrating this season. I think we've seen pressure of traveling hunters increase exponentially. And so I did more pheasant hunting this year than I probably have the entire time I've lived out here. And our pheasant numbers were just unbelievable. I have not seen pheasant numbers like we had last year, particularly after the winter that we had. Last year we came off one of the worst winters that we've ever had, and somehow managed to produce a pretty nice hatch of pheasants, and it had a phenomenal pheasant season. And it was one, you know, a couple years ago they expanded our season to the end of January, which oftentimes is a moot point because we're, you know, buried in snow by that point.
Yeah.
This year we were able to hunt right up to the end of January, and I actually quit on the last day because the dogs got hot because it was so warm at the end of January out here. So it was a great season. I could not complain at all.
You know, it's funny. I think it's still true. At least the last time I was in South Dakota, there was a few days ahead of the regular season where residents only could hunt. And it sounds like that's a new strategy for the end of the hunt as well. No one else is going to risk driving all the way over there for, like you said, a field that is 3 foot deep in snow. But you got the best of it at the end of the season.
This year we did, absolutely. Last year was not the case. We were done before December, I think, last year, with just feet of snow everywhere. But this year we got to hunt right up to the very end, which was phenomenal. And like you say, most people aren't planning trips for that time of year. They're going to try to get it in, you know, typically before Thanksgiving.
I love it. Well, good for you. I'm glad you had a good time. What was the highlight of your upland season this year?
Whew. Well, so I had a hunt where on 2 days before I had hunted with two buddies, and they both thought they had clipped roosters that we were on. They sailed, and there was no us or the dogs getting to them. I hunted the spot 2 days later, and in my lab came up with two very lively wing-clipped roosters. And ironically, they were within 5 feet of each other, and so they somehow had managed to regroup. And so she got two-thirds of my limit that day recovering birds that we thought we had lost 2 days before. So that by far, I think, was the highlight of my season.
Yeah, that is almost, you know, as a conservationist and as a dog owner, that is almost one of those kind of minor miracles that I had that happen on a chucker hunt a couple years back. And the guy said, yeah, you know, I wing clipped one right in here this year. And then all of a sudden, here comes my dog with a very live chucker in his mouth. And that was it. So glad to hear. Hey, we're, you know, conserved game. Hunt with a trained dog.
Exactly.
Well, we're here to talk about taking care of our trained dog, and training being a relative term, we won't go down that road, but you see a lot of the things that we all experience on a less frequent basis. Do you guys keep a scoreboard during the season? What are the most common injuries or whatever that you treat among bird dogs in your practice?
Yeah, you know, probably lacerations is at the top of that list.
Yeah.
It almost becomes a mundane sort of thing because it is so common during hunting season.
Yeah.
I think probably the two more interesting things that we see are horn bodies up the nose.
Ew.
And if on Instagram, on my Instagram account this year, I posted, it was almost weekly, of what am I going to pull out of this dog's nose, and shared videos to that effect. And then I think the eyes are the other big area, whether it be, you know, ulcerations or abrasions to the surface of the eye, or again, foreign material that gets stuck in the eye. I think that those three, lacerations, the nose and the eye, are probably high up on the list of things we see at the clinic on Mondays and Tuesdays.
Yeah, I'll never forget hunting in California, of all places. My dog is laying on the floor on my sister's brand new white carpet. One violent sneeze, and here comes a 4-inch stick out of one nostril. And of course, it was bleeding. So what else have you found up a dog's nose?
A lot of it's that. It sticks. It's you know, cattails will get up there. The stiffer, you know, like big blue stem in switchgrass, those stiffer reeds will get up there.
Yeah.
And then seeds is the other big thing, especially, you know, you get like foxtail-y type of things that yeah. want to stick someplace. We inevitably end up pulling, you know, several of those out every year as well.
Do you, what would you advise us? I mean, how do we know that might be a problem? Is my dog will sneeze, of course, or maybe some will shake their head a little bit, but that's more of an ear thing. But what do we watch for, and when should we bring our dog to you?
Yeah, so it is. There's always that balance of there's a certain set of dogs that get some irritation just from the dusty conditions,
sure.
and the early season when there's still pollen. And it's differentiating that, like, is it just irritation or is there something stuck up there? And I think the kind of key points that there's probably something more going up, you know, more than just irritation, is one would be more discharge out of one side than the other. And so you notice that, you know, the nose is running, but maybe the right nostril, it's a little more opaque or even yellow, or it's even if it's just even more watery out one side versus the other, there's probably something up there irritating it. And so that's probably my hallmark. And then
sure.
you talked about the shaking of the head. And it is. So you'll notice, like, with an irritation, it is just a sneeze. When they have something up there, it's more of a, like, a sneeze with the whole head involved.
Yeah.
Where they're trying to almost shake and sneeze something out. It's not the same shake as when they have an ear infection or something in their ear, but there's a noticeable, like, I don't know, like, it's a more powerful effort with the sneeze trying to dislodge what's ever up there. And then I think the persistence of it too, where it's just like, you know, usually when a dog sneezes from irritation, it's just like a one-time sneeze, where usually if there's something stuck up there, it would be kind of a cluster, like they're trying to move it around and then they give up. So the discharge and the character of the sneezing are kind of the two things that lead me to, do I need to sedate this dog and look?
Can we do anything about that? If we don't know what we're doing, we could probably do more damage, can't we?
Correct. I will say, you know, that they very rarely are you going to cause something, you know, to be more problematic. Like, I think flushing the nose is something that people can do, and I advocate for it, particularly if you're on the, you know, if you know there's a stick up there was bloody discharge out one side, it's persistent, then I won't monkey around with that. But, you know, you get back to the truck and the dog sneezing just seems kind of like uncomfortable, that you wonder what's going on. I'll take saline and I'll run it in each nostril. And so just like the same stuff that you use to flush the eyes, not contact lens cleaner or any of the abrasive things, just straight saline. And you don't want to squirt it like you're trying to flush out the eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
You're just running that liquid into each nostril and you'll see the dog start to swallow. It's not going to flush a stick out. It's not going to flush something big out. But what it will do is potentially clear up if it's, say, dust or pollen.
Sure.
So essentially, you know, what you're doing is kind of you're neti potting the dog's nose. You're just asking them to swallow as opposed to, you know, dripping it out the other side of the nostril like when somebody uses a neti pot. But you're just trying to flush those passages.
Got it.
That I think you're not going to cause a lot of problems trying to do that. You know, if you know there's something up there, I wouldn't monkey around. If you can see it, and so what I tell people on that front is if you can see it, it's kind of like the game of Operation. You probably have about one shot, and you cannot touch anything except whatever you're trying to grab.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it is, there's times when that will, a bit of that will be kind of sticking out. And what I advocate is using hemostats in that, you know, place where you're going to latch onto, because typically what will happen, the dog's going to pull its head back. You're not going to actually pull the item out.
Yeah.
But you usually have about one shot if you can see the foreign body, and you want to be real cautious and not, you know, not blow your one opportunity. opportunity to try and grab that thing.
I'm reliving all of those attempts myself right now as you're describing it. Oh, man. And you know, let's just go on the record here, because you mentioned foxtails out in the West here. It's cheatgrass, but all of those seeds that are, that I think they generally term awns, A-W-N, awn, they can have a, I mean, they are life-threatening, and we shouldn't ignore them. And why is that?
Yeah, so they have, you know, the ones you referenced, so the, you know, the foxtail, the other big one in this part of the country that I think that people don't appreciate until they have a problem with it is Canada rye.
Yeah.
And it's a seed that's in a lot of the mixes used in habitat restoration with CRP. And then, you know, as you mentioned, cheatgrass out west, needle and thread is another one. The seeds have barbs on them, and they want to migrate in the body. And so where we see them is places that they shouldn't be. And so they can get into the chest if a dog inhales them, and it is life-threatening. And so they'll oftentimes puncture out of the lung and cause a pus-filled chest, what we call a pyothorax. And it will kill dogs. And so we see dogs, you know, every year die from migrating foreign bodies. And it can really be anywhere. So we'll have them, you know, I can't think of a place that we haven't removed something from dogs of this nature. And so it can be, you know, in the back muscles, we've had it up against the spine. Basically, these seeds can migrate anywhere and can either enter the body through, like, either the mouth or inhaling, or they can puncture as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to keep referencing, like, my Instagram account, but I have some videos on there as well that show those seeds under the microscope. And in some of the cases that we'll see, and it is one that if we think that's what's going on, oftentimes I have a path that I take that's a conservative path for the initial treatment. But if that doesn't work and we need to do surgery, it's a surgery that needs to be in the hands of a board certified surgeon, because we treat it like cancer. And so everybody thinks that we're going to do a CT or some type of diagnostic and we're going to see exactly where that seed or migrating foreign body is. And you don't. You get an idea based on what the tissues and things look like of where it probably is, but we're not going into the haystack to find the needle. Basically, what the surgeon does is he's taking out the entire haystack, hoping that the needle is still in there. And so, you know, everybody thinks these surgeries are rewarding, that you're like, ah, here we go, we found the thing, and that's not the case. Oftentimes, we do these surgeries and don't find the offending thing. We're just taking out everything that might be affected. What it amounts to.
Well, hopefully that's why you are what you are. That's Joe Spoo, the Gun Dog Doc, and that's where you find more of this kind of stuff, gundogdoc.com. I'm Scott Linden, the host here at the Upland Nation podcast. Joe, speaking of your social media, you're doing some other things. You just launched, for example, a learning opportunity for us. What are you doing online that we might be able to take advantage of?
Yeah, so I've spent the last year putting together a field emergency and first aid course for dog owners. And so it's a 60-plus video course that covers the topics that we've talked about, you know, in the first part of this episode. And so I go through and teach people how to fix lacerations in the field, flushing the eyes, flushing the nose. I cover unique conditions that you know, hunting dogs get, like heat stroke, exertional rhabdomyolysis. With the migrating foreign bodies, I have an entire section devoted to that, because I think it is something that not every veterinarian understands. And
yeah.
So, you know, it's a condition unique to hunting dogs. And there's times that, you know, I in some of the modules, I'm providing how you're going to treat the dog in the field. In instances like the migrating foreign body, this is the information you're going to need in order to advocate for your dog when you get to the veterinarian. And it's not a knock on veterinarians. You know, I'll be the first to say I hate when somebody comes, you know, in and says, well, so-and-so told me this is how you should treat the case. The fact of the matter is that a lot of veterinarians are not going to be familiar with some of these unique conditions of hunting dogs. And so what I try to do is create a course that's going to empower dog owners. I think that there's times too that people get a little hesitant to treat things that they should be treating out in the field. You know, it's where the places we hunt, there isn't always a veterinarian. And oftentimes in the places we hunt, that veterinarian might not be a small animal veterinarian, anyway. And so there are things that you can do that can at least start the healing process until you get into the hands of the veterinarian. In some cases, your treatment is going to be all that's needed, as opposed to trying to track somebody down or not being able to track somebody down, or potentially completely ending your hunt. When if you had these tools in your toolbox to be able to handle these situations, oftentimes you keep these dogs out in the field hunting. It's not meant to be a replacement for veterinary care. It's meant to supplement what you're able to do for your dog and keep that dog healthy and out in the field.
Well, speaking of that sort of thing, let's end this segment with a little bit of talk about the most common injury and what we can do in the field. And I'll give you a perfect example. I've got 1 million acres of public ground right beyond my back fence. And, 6 months, of course, middle of the bird season, my dog Flick is on one side of a hill. I'm on the other. I hear a yelp, and then I hear 3 or 4 more yelps. So I'm heading over there ready for a coyote encounter. But no, he's trotting back to me with about a silver dollar size hole on his inner thigh. And that turned into a real mess for me because it didn't heal well. I thought I'd closed it up. But what should I have done and what should we do when our dog shows up? Well, whether it's the end of the day or in the middle of the hunt with a big hole in him.
Yeah, so a lot depends on depth.
And yeah.
So I think, you know, the thing that, you know, in the course that I try to teach people is recognizing the ones you should close and recognizing the ones you shouldn't close.
Yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with depth and location. And so, you know, what I think the big thing is, if it's through the skin and just into the fat, you're not going multiple layers in. Most of those can be closed by people in the field. You know, I think the other mistake that people make on the ones they close is that they just want to get it closed right away.
Yeah.
And cleaning some more and flushing and cleaning some more is going to put the odds in your favor, because we're out in places that are dirty, right? And if that dog gets a speck of seed or a speck of dust or dirt up in that cut and we don't get that out, even if we close it, it looks pretty, that body's going to reject that material that shouldn't be there. And a lot of these are delayed in healing and don't fully heal because we did take that time on the front end to fully clean them. And then I think the other part too is that a lot of people, you know, I see posts online all the time of people so proud of stitching and using suture to close wounds.
Ew.
And I'm not big on that at all. Ew. I think if it's a wound that can be closed in the field, your best bet is to use staples. They're clean, they're effective. You're not dragging suture material across your tailgate and again, contaminating it while you're putting it in the dog. I can close both sides of a wound with one staple versus you're poking, trying to do the sutures.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't close lacerations with suture, and so I do, but it's the ones that I think need to probably be under anesthesia.
Yeah.
That I'm close. Like if there's something deeper that I need to flush, that, you know, a dog that, say, runs into a fence post or a tree and jams it into his chest, and that, you know, it's more, you can see there's a penetrating, that dog's not going to allow thorough cleaning unless it's under sedation. So that's going to be a dog that, you know, like, I'm going to sedate, I'm going to probe up their deep flush, and then I'm going to use suture to close. But a lot of these superficial ones, it's about understanding it's superficial, getting it cleaned effectively, and then your closure method. And I'm a less is more guy. You know, staples are a very effective, good way to clean these wounds or to close these wounds. And I think a lot of people get carried away about overkill and trying to, you know, over close them, and that a lot of problems develop from that as well.
Well, I learned the hard way and got a lesson one night from a veterinarian in the middle of nowhere how to use a stapler, a surgical stapler. But is there, can we practice somehow? Is there a way where we can get better at this before we need to do it in the middle of nowhere?
I mean, yeah, the staplers, you know, if you haven't used them, you know, you can, they're very simple once you understand how to use them. And so the big thing with them is just understanding where the staples come out and what they're going to do. They're very similar to the desk staplers, you know, where they come out on each side. Almost all of them have an arrow on them that shows you where you should be pointing the stapler as far as where the wounds come together. And so, you know, they're fairly inexpensive. Like, I don't think it'd be, you know, if you're intimidated by them, I think taking, you know, purchasing one, taking it out of the packaging and practicing on, you know, whether it's two pieces of leather, you know, or the next time, you know, you shoot a bird and make an incision and use their skin. You know, the big thing is just knowing where those staples are coming out. I think the other thing too is that, you know, when people think of staplers, like when you're stapling paper, the staple gets compressed, right? So it pokes through the paper and it gets compressed. With these staples, in with the skin stapler, it basically forms a loop. And so the ends don't come completely together, but it's forming a circle like a suture would be in that situation.
Got it.
And so I think, you know, understanding that mechanism by wasting some staples to see what's occurring is important. And that's, you know, to your point, you know, that's kind of why I developed the course, is to prepare people for these emergencies before they need to. You
I
know,
love
most
it.
of us will run these dogs, and 99% of the time that we own them, there won't be a problem, right? They're healthy, they're active, they're doing everything we want. But nothing makes you sicker on a hunt than, like you said, you hear your dog yelp and you come walking back with this gaping hole. Because that ends the hunt, right? Like, you can have a gun that misfires, you can have, you know, a rainstorm move in that you have to sit out. Like, those are things that you can recover from. Like, dealing with your hunting buddy injured, that it's a whole different experience for people. And so being prepared before you're put in that situation, I think, is vitally important to handling it correctly and not letting the wheels come off and making that situation worse.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a lot of that covered in that course. So, if you want more information on that, go to gundogdoc.com. That's Joe Spoo. He is the Gun Dog Doc. I'm Scott Linden. I am not. Joe, if you'll just stand by for a moment, and everybody else as well, because we've got the Handle It segment coming up later. A question from Ben Waters on battles for birds when two dogs go after a retrieve. And it's all coming up after this word from LandTrust.com. Yeah, just watched a good friend, her video on a hunt she did in LandTrust.com's catalog, if you will. Another great Montana sharptail hunt, by the way. There's so many properties out there for that, but all sorts of other properties as well, all over the country. It's a sharing marketplace. Just like, you know, VRBO or something like that. You go online, you find a place you like, you make a reservation for a day, for 2 days. Some of them have lodging, some of them have camping ability. They're all private ground managed for agriculture and recreation. Exclusive private land access. It takes the stress out of planning your upland hunt. You focus on the important stuff, your dog and the incredible scenery and the chance to shoot at a bird or two. It's all available at landtrust.com. Get more information at landtrust.com. And once you get out there, you want to shoot straight. Of course, you want to shoot better. Change your chokes. TrueLockChokes.com has 2,000 choices for you, no matter what you're doing. You want to be a better shooter, put in some well-built, guaranteed chokes made out of the right materials for the right applications. Sign up for email notifications on sales and other promotions at TrueLockChokes.com. TRULOCK, TrueLockChokes.com. And welcome back, Joe Spoo, the Gun Dog Doc, to the Upland Nation podcast. Joe, what kind of dogs are you running?
Right now, I have a female lab and a 7-year-old male setter. I'm in the I would say market. We're going to be adding a cocker puppy back to the mix as well. So in the past, I've usually had two setters, and then a field bred cocker. I've had Chessies in the past, but to me, kind of the ultimate combo is the setter retriever spaniel mix. And so we're hopefully this summer we'll be adding a field bred cocker back to the household.
I'm just cringing at the amount of grooming you're going to have. You already have enough and you're just adding to it. And that actually, that's a good question. You know, you probably had more experience in the practice and then at home too on getting all that stuff out of a dog's coat. Is there a secret that you veterinarians learn that we don't know about that will help us pull all the mats and all of the you know, the seeds and the burrs out of a dog's coat?
There isn't. It honestly is one of my most dreaded things. Like, what I would say is, like with the setters and the cocker, you know, that type of coat is keeping them groomed.
Yeah.
And grooming sounds like such a simple thing, but like I will tell you that not all groomers are created equal. You know, I've been doing this for about 25 years and worked with a number of groomers over the course of that time. And I have two that I like trust with my dogs, one at the front end of my career and the one I have now, because it can make or break some, you know, issues with that dog. And you know, just some of that feathering, some of the coat you need for the, you know, protective nature. And so like having a groomer that understands the functionality of these dogs is super important. And I think that's the biggest thing. And there's been times, you know, where you know, stuff is busy at the end of summer and I forget to get the dogs groomed before opener and you head out and come back and their, you know, their ears are matted together on the top of their head. And, you know, I text my groomer, I'm like, Lacey, do you have an opening this week? I screwed up. Because it's, you know, the keeping the coat in check, I think, is the most vital. I mean, and even on the retriever front, you know, like when I had my Chessie, I'd get her groomed professionally twice a year. Those dogs that get that thick undercoat, you know, when they blow it out in the spring and then when they're putting the coat on in the fall, they oftentimes kind of blow out their cruddy summer coat. The groomers can really accelerate that process. And so, you know, between their strippers and you know, the blowers that they use to blow out the coat, I feel like they can, you know, instead of where you're, you know, sweeping up dust bunnies for months on end, they can really shorten that window down. So even the dogs that we traditionally don't think of as needing grooming, I'll usually spring, you know, for grooming on those dogs a time or two out of the year just to help with the shedding process. So
you have a setter, and one of the solutions a lot of people go to is just shave the coat down. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I like some coat on a setter. I like some of the feathering and things like that. So I think it's a personal, you know, just your personal preference on that front. In the start of the season this summer, I keep him pretty short. I haven't cut her pretty short, but never to the point that he doesn't have just have a little bit of dressings on there you know, to tell that he's a setter.
Great. Gundog Doc, Joe Spoo, board certified, really focusing on hunting dogs. I'm loving this conversation. And I know you've covered this in some of your videos, but in that first aid kit for dogs, I'm sure you have one or two or more things that we probably haven't thought of. Can you just make sure that we know about those and stock them for this season?
That's an interesting one. So, I have a pretty simplistic first aid kit. I guess I'll go on record as saying that. I think, you know, my opinion is that people fall into two categories. They either, you know, have basically an ambulance and think they're an EMT and are, you know, they'll so proudly show you how half of their depth system is first aid material. And then I think the other group is people that don't carry enough other than their cell phone and hope to God that if something happens, that there's a vet someplace that they can get their dog to.
Yeah.
And I think both groups are probably in error. You're not doing trauma surgery out in the field. Like, I have everything I could ever need to do that, and it's not what I carry into the field. And so to me, it's more about having enough to treat and stabilize the things that you can. And so I would say, you know, having the simpler first aid kit is and knowing what you have in there. And it's one of my knock on the ones that you can purchase is, you know, they got to put filler in there, right? Because you got to be purchasing something. But you're having to restock some things that you actually use. And so do you have to buy a whole new kit to do that or not? And so the big things I advocate for people are you know, have a few pieces of equipment. So like your hemostats, needle nose pliers, the skin staplers, things that you're going to address those wounds, you know, pulling stuff out of the dog, whether that be the ears or, you know, porcupine quills, having things to clean the wounds. And so I go through bottles and bottles of saline every year, to flush the eyes. That's what I use for my wound cleaning. I mentioned the nose earlier. And then having bandage material to cover those wounds. I'm not too heavy on the medication front. We, you know, it used to be that we carry a lot of antibiotics and we do different things, but as we, you know, have come to realize antibiotic resistance is a real thing, a lot of these wounds and issues, if we get them cleaned up and addressed correctly, we don't have to automatically jump on antibiotics or wait till they get infected. And so, the antibiotics I do carry, like a triple antibiotic, like a Neosporin type of thing. I never treat wounds with that, but it provides a temporary bandage. It's also something that you use, like if you have a clippers along and you're closing the laceration, if you fill that wound with that Neosporin, it'll catch that hair. And so then after you're done clipping the hair, you can just with one wipe, well, away that Neosporin and all the hair will go with it. And then I carry antibiotic for the eye. The eye is the one place that I do have a specific triple antibiotic for the eye. Because the eyes are fragile, and so I want to be able to, if I think I need to treat them, I'll treat them. And so to me, I'd say simplify is important. Know what you have, and then know what you need to replace. You know, I go through a ton of bandage material a year, and so, you know, I buy that in bulk now, so whether that's
sure.
that wrap or the cling, and I keep that box in my garage by my truck, and so it's no different than reloading, you know, when I get low on shells, I throw more shells in the truck. Same thing with the bandage material. If I need to throw bandage material in there, I do on the website have a free it's a quick 6 email course. You get 6 videos to your inbox that go over my first aid kit recommendations. That's a free course on my website. And I break it down into exactly that, where it's tools, wound care, medications. I go over what I carry in my vest as opposed to in my truck.
Yeah.
And so that's an even smaller stripped down version. And so I do have that for free on the website to be able to sign up and get my exact list. But I think it's simplification, right? Address the things you can and don't overwhelm yourself with a lot of gear that you're never going to use.
Yeah, let's just make sure we got this on the eye ointment. It can't be probably the same as the triple antibiotic. Well, we want to worry about a scratched cornea. And I know when we take a dog in, first thing a veterinarian's going to do is I think you use a dye of some sort.
Yeah, fluorescein stain. So you stain the eye to look for an ulcer on the cornea.
So we want to use definitely an ophthalmic antiseptic ointment, not just the, you know, the Neosporin or something like that.
Correct.
In an eye,
right? It'll be an ophthalmic triple antibiotic.
Right. Okay.
And you'll want to get it from your veterinarian. And I can't imagine there's a vet out there that you explain, you know, hey, this is what I do with these dogs. I'd like it for my first aid kit. I can't imagine there's a veterinarian that would be against
Absolutely. Yeah.
The thing with like the Neosporin and the things that are meant top, they're going to burn and irritate the eye. So you need it specifically formulated for the eye. That's the one prescription, call it medication, that I would carry. The other thing too, we talk about what should be in your first aid kit. If you do have a dog that's on prescription medication, you know, whether that be thyroid medication or seizure medication, things like that, I would throw several doses into your first aid kit.
Sure.
You know, inevitably you go on that hunting trip or a trip that, you know, ends up being extended and you forget to grab the pill bottle, that we always will have some of those prescription medications with you to get your dog through several days of a road trip.
Great idea. Love that. Let's touch on a subject that it seems to be in flux a little bit. Rattlesnake vaccine. Yeah, well, that's the discussion I have twice a year at my veterinarian's office, and it ends about the same.
I think our connection is getting bad.
I've heard all sorts of things, and I was pretty hot on that topic when they first came out with this. But the more we learn, the more we learn that it's not all it's cracked up to be. As a professional in that world, what are your thoughts?
So I'll give the disclaimer. I'm very evidence-based. research based, and I like there to be, more than anecdotal evidence about things. With or without a snake vaccine, a lot of that does not exist. I will, and with that, I will also say that I have colleagues in other parts of the country that think it's snake oil, no pun intended, and won't use it, don't use it, think it's horrible. In South Dakota, I think it works well, and I've used it essentially from the beginning, and I continue to use it in client in my own dogs. We, on the part of the state I live in, we do not have rattlesnakes. They're in the western part of the state. I'm in a unique situation, and with my wife and I being the only specialist in the state, we get referrals from all over the state. And so one of the common questions I ask the veterinarians in snake country is their thoughts on it. And in South Dakota, they wholeheartedly believe in it because the dogs that get bit by rattlesnakes, our prairie rattler that we have here, if they've been vaccinated, oftentimes require no treatment, no hospitalization, and do much better. And so I think it probably is very location dependent on whether that vaccine works in certain snakes. And so I think that, depending upon where you live and asking veterinarians their experience with it, or the places that you travel, reaching out. But I don't want to say feel strongly. I do feel, and I'm not one to recommend things to clients that I don't do in my own dogs, whether that's nutrition or heartworm medication or surgical procedures. I like the It has to be something I believe in. And this is one with my own dogs. I use the rattlesnake vaccine because I think it's effective in the places that I hunt. But I do not dismiss or I, you know, I don't have a disbelief that others feel strongly that it doesn't work. Probably in their locales, it does not work. And I think that's kind of the big thing is it's obviously not a one size fits all as far as that product goes. I think it's very dependent on location and probably, level of venom and potency of venom and things like that are probably variable, from snakes from region to region. And that's probably part of it. So that's a long-winded answer to say I use it, but I think there needs to be some of that, qualification. I don't discredit people that think it's not effective in their areas. I just it's been my experience in where I practice and hunt that people feel that the vaccine is very effective.
Well, you hit on this in the same way I look at it. There are certain types of rattlesnakes where it's very effective and certain types when it's not. And a lot of people would look at it and simply say, well, there's no downside and there's all this upside, so why not? But I get it. And I understand completely. Let's talk a little bit about the end of the hunt. We all have our own version of a tailgate check, and hopefully we're doing that every time. And not just during hunting season. Like I said, stuff happens right out there. I'm looking through the window right now at that million acres of public ground. A lot of things happen every day when we're out there. What are the things that you do on your tailgate check that we might not have thought about?
Yeah, so I think, part of it goes back to the whole migrating seeds in the foreign bodies. And so at the end of every single run, I'm looking in the eyes, nose, and then the kind of the jowly pockets formed on the side of the mouth, because you can get seeds back in there as well. And so, if I get back to the truck and the dog looks great, that's the areas I'm looking at every single time I put them on the ground. And then for sure at the end of the day, or if I'm suspicious that there's more going on, then I do my full tailgate check. And it's basically in the nose tail, toenails, the back, and everything in between. Into quick, like it sounds like, oh, he's saying do a thorough exam, which I am, but we're talking, minutes and if not less when you get used to it. The big thing I think is, evaluating joints. Are there any swelling, pain, issues with that dog? And then looking in the hidden areas, and I think, over the years, because I advocate the tailgate exam and I've trained my clients, we don't see this as much. But 10, 15 years ago, it would be common on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday that we'd have the dog come in that had been hunting on Saturday, Sunday, and it got home, rolled over on its belly for a family member to pet it the next day, and it had a huge cut up in the armpit in the groin area. in those hidden areas that you have to actually try to look in order to see.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, really look in those common areas that a dog's going to get a fence cut. I think it still baffles most people that these dogs, they can lay themselves completely open, and by the time you get back to the truck, they're not dripping blood at all. And so you can have this huge wound that's not bleeding, and there is no blood. And so, you know, you have to get your hands on these dogs. You have to get your eyes on those hidden areas. And then really the tailgate check should start before you get on the tailgate, right?
It's
watching that dog as it walks back. You know, are they just tired because it's the end of the day? Or is there something off? Are they limping? And I need to focus on that area that I think that is problematic. You know, started is your perception of the dog as you get back to the truck. But the eyes, nose, and mouth get looked at every time I run a dog in the field. The whole dog, you know, at the end of every day for sure. And sometimes at the end of every hunt, and depending upon, you know, how beat up they are, or if I'm suspicious that there's an issue going on.
And if you're colorblind like me, you ought to do something with your hands. I run my hands over every square inch of my brown dog, because against brown fur, I can't see red blood until it comes off on my hand. So I'm going a little bit more thoroughly than many people. But if you doubt any of that, just listen to this lesson. So Flick ran into a wire fence, barbed wire fence, a couple of years ago. That's how we closed out the chucker season, with a cone on his head. But I drag him over to the vet, and I say, he's got a cut here on this leg and another one here. And she says, well, what about that big gash on his chest? And I said, what? I hadn't even seen it. That's how bad my colorblindness is. So got lucky on that. And you know, since then, I've asked whoever I'm with to take a second look at all of those possible cuts that might be there that I haven't noticed, and it's paid off once or twice. So thanks for that advice. Armpits, thighs, all those places we don't think to look. One of the reasons I like to put that dog up on a high spot is you can just lean over a little bit and look underneath at the undercarriage there. It helps a lot, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So Joe, we're getting towards the end. That's Joe Spoo, gundogdoc.com is where you learn more about him. But if you wanted to leave us with any advice when it came to performance, our dog in the field is much like you in the past, you know, an ultimate athlete, doing things that we could never do ourselves, day after day, barefoot and naked. So how do we ensure that dog is working at its peak, is performing, whether it's nutritionally or any other way? What can we do as owners?
Yeah, so I think you hit it for me. Is nutrition, I think, is the most important. And it starts when you get the pup and realize that you're building the athlete that you're going to have for the rest of its life, which is hopefully, you know, another decade and a half potentially. And so making sure that dog is never overweight. And so the problem, you know, that I see is roly-poly puppies are cute. We get people that want to, you know, because their trainer or their breeder only feeds performance diets to their whole kennel, that's what they think they should. And all of these athletic breed dogs should be on like a large breed growth formula. And so it's restricted in calcium so that we can lay those bones down in the correct manner in the joints. And so it starts in that first, you know, 12 to 18 months, making sure that you're building your athlete correctly and using the appropriate nutrition. And then from that point on, it's keeping them in that optimum body condition. Too frequently is we see the yo-yoing, and I'll have dogs that come in when we've had a long winter. We see them in the spring and they're overweight, and you know, oh yeah, we're gonna start training, we'll take that weight off, and they take the weight off in the spring, and then we get to hunting season, and you know, July and August are miserably hot, so that dog wasn't getting trained like it should have in condition. It gets heavy again, and we're going to season heavy. Oh yeah, well they'll thin out during hunting season, and we just constantly yo-yo. People get in the habit of, you know, and we kind of promote it in veterinary medicine. When you come in, one of the questions that the staff asks is, how do you feed your dog? One cup, twice a day. And we get into that habit of the same amount all the time.
Yeah.
When the activity level of these dogs varies so greatly. And so it you know, you need to be looking at your nutrition plan in a periodization, to borrow a term from human performance. And, you know, what formula should I be on? What amount should I be on? And does that need to adjust? And I use my two dogs as examples. You know, the lab and the setter both happen to be exactly 50 pounds, but they cover ground so much differently and their workload is so vastly different that they never get fed the same amount. And, you know, like right
yeah,
now,
yeah.
My lab is recovering from surgery. And so she's not exercising very much, obviously, at all. And so she's getting 3/4 of a cup twice a day, where my exact same weight setter is running with me and running like a banshee, and he'll get, you know, 1¼ cups or 1½ cups twice a day. So more than double what she's getting, and they're the same weight. So if I based it on, you know, the back of the bag guidance and, you know, the dog, they should be getting the same amount, right? Because they weigh the same. And that's just not the case. You really have to feed to the dog. I tell people the back of the bag is guidance. It's not gospel. And get your, again, hands on your dog. You should be able to feel the ribs. You can feel the point of the hips, but if they get dippy on the back of those hips, then we need to up it. If
okay.
They start going away, we need to decrease the amount. I think, you know, the vast majority of the problems that I see in the clinic are related to that we don't keep these dogs in an optimal physical condition. And once some of those negative cascades start, I can't undo them. So, you know, if we overfeed a puppy and we create hip dysplasia, or we have issues, you know, with the shoulders or the knees, I can't unwind that as a rehab veterinarian at 5. And same with later in life, you know, it's one that I think so often we look at age as a disease, and it's not, it's a number. I think we perpetuate the myth that we hit these numbers and we need to start slowing down, whether it's us or whether it's our dogs. My last daughter that passed away at 16 and a half hunted through to age 15, so her 16th season. I still have a freezer full of birds that season, every bird she shot at. Well, this is going to be the last one. This is going to be the last one. And at 15, she was a very effective hunter. And it's keeping that mentality that, you know, we're going to use it and keep her happy and healthy and keep her out in the field and not have these guys yo-yo and keep them as the athletes that they are.
Well, there's a lesson from you, from the only guy in South Dakota with a 50-pound Labrador, by the way. Most of them you can put a saddle on, but that's another story. That's Joe Spoo, the Gun Dog Doc. Learn more about all of this and great, great videos and things. You will learn something every time you go, whether it's on his Instagram or on his website, gundogdoc.com. I know I learned a lot. I hope everybody else did too. Joe Spoo, thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And the rest of you, don't go away. We've got a lot more to talk about, including that question from Ben Waters on who gets the retrieve and who has to stand still when you're managing a two-dog hunt. It's all brought to you by MidwayUSA.com. Yeah, they carry just about everything. In fact, I love doing this. I just go on and start piling stuff into my shopping cart. And what did I do the last one? Oh, some ammo. Yeah, some Target ammo. They always got it. I mean, and that may be less true for you locally. So if you're looking for another source for ammo, that's a good one. But also, I got a salmon net. No, not for salmon, for my pigeons, and a few other things like that. They've got a little bit of everything, and if you're looking for a deal, sign up for their email or text messaging, and you'll get 10% off your next order. Yeah, it could add up. They've also got non-toxic ammo, all types, and whether it's a handgun, long rifle, or a shotgun, you'll find something for you in that regard in the dog care, dog training, and the bird hunting world. It's all at MidwayUSA.com. And hey, good news from my friend Fred Bohm at SageandBreaker.com. Back in stock, all of their boar cleaning products. Yeah, big run on those recently. And some other good news, Father's Day sale coming up. If you haven't gotten onto their mailing list yet, this may be your first notification of that sale, and the product's back in stock. So sign up at sageandbreaker.com. Get in on all the new products, all the products as they come back online, and of course, the rare sale here and there at sageandbreaker.com. Well, I'm sure enjoying the questions I'm getting on the social media about managing, handling, working with, caring for dogs, and thought I'd answer a question from Ben Waters this week on the program. Ben, thanks for your question. He says, I'm training a new pup. She's pointing, finding birds well. She has such a sweet spirit. And don't you love that aspect of it as well? But Ben says, after the shot and when another dog is retrieving the bird, things get aggressive and ugly. Yeah, been there, done that. Birds are getting destroyed. Yeah. So what do we do here? Well, the first thing that I thought of is something that I've been working on a lot lately. Watch some of the videos, in fact, at MidwayUSA.com on teaching a dog to whoa, and how whoa is not an instinctive pointing thing. You do chain that into that, but teach a dog to whoa and to stay still. It's a command. It's an obedience command. So going back to square one, your dog should learn that when they do point and another dog points and the bird gets up, you say the word whoa. The gunshot should be another version of that command. Whatever it takes, the dog doesn't move. In other words, create a dog that's steady to wing and shot, and ideally to fall, because the other dog may not be. Only one dog should go for that retrieve, and you can work it out with a partner. You can work it out any way you like, but no dog should go until they're commanded to go for the retrieve. Train for that. Bring another dog in on the training scenarios. Flip a coin. Somebody buys the beer at the end of the day if their dog gets the retrieve. Whatever it is, dogs don't go for the retrieve until they're told to go for the retrieve. Josh Robinson on our Facebook page says he has a great video of how to avoid this. So take a look at the Facebook and the Instagram pages. Learn more from all the other experts out there as well. Thanks for your question, Ben. Good luck. And Handle It This Week was brought to you by ESPAmerica.com. Yeah, you know, hearing loss is cumulative and permanent. So if you're looking for hearing protection devices, invest in custom digital devices from ESP America. Yeah, I'm sure enjoying mine, using them every time I set foot in the field with a shotgun. And the joy is they have some attributes that minimize wind noise. If you've ever had electronic hearing protection devices, you know that's a real bugaboo. They put the microphone in a spot so where it is sheltered by the anatomy of your ear. And then they have patented digital software that minimizes that. Little wind noise, very comfortable, and they stay in. ESPAmerica.com. And I'm using those ESP products when I shoot at the Mid Valley Clays and Shooting School. MidValleyClays.com is where you learn more about their clay target games and the shooting lessons from folks who are not only champion clay target shooters, but are also avid hunters. MidValleyClays.com is also where you get the phone number for Dave Fiedler, the proprietor out there, champion shooter, avid hunter, and glad to be your shotgun guru. When you start your shopping adventure, call Dave, tell him what you're looking for, tell him why you're looking for it. He'll ask a few questions about, you know, what you're shooting at, where you're going, that sort of thing. Even your dog breed sometimes is important. He'll ask the questions and make a recommendation based on real-world experience. Mid Valley Clays is also sub-gauge central, so if you're looking for something other than a 12-gauge, they've always got them in stock. And some very hard-to-find guns, Dave's got a line on those as well. Go to midvalleyclays.com, get the phone number, talk with my good friend Dave Fiedler. And thank you all for listening. Thank you, Joe Spoo, the Gun Dog Doc. Learned a lot there, and we'll learn more watching some of your videos. I hope you all did as well. If you commented or offered suggestions to other fellow hunters on the social platforms, thank you so much on everybody's behalf. We are made possible by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, Purina Pro Plan Sport Dog Food, ESPAmerica.com, Hearing Protection Devices, Mid Valley Clays and Shooting School, TruLock Chokes, MidwayUSA.com, LandTrust.com, and High Viz Shooting Systems. Well, if you're out shooting, maybe we'll run into each other at a range, or maybe at a training day. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks for listening to the Upland Nation Podcast.